When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is the Music Buzz Podcast. The Music Buzz Podcast features candid discussions with and about those behind the scenes in the music business, including industry veterans representing the segments of musician, design, and live. All three Music Buzz podcast hosts have spent their careers working with the biggest names in entertainment and have been and are still a fly on the wall. Dane Clark as the drummer for John Mellencamp's band for over 20 years and various solo projects. Hugh Syme, a world-renowned graphic artist for the biggest names in music and the corporate world. Andy Wilson, an award-winning marketing and public relations executive with over 20 years of combined multi-level entertainment industry experience in the music and sports business. Now let's buzz.
Hello and welcome back to the Music Buzz Podcast. I'm one of your co-hosts, Andy Wilson, along with Dane Clark. How you doing, Dane?
Great, Andy. How are you today?
I'm good. And also Hugh Syme. Hey, Hugh.
Hey, Andy. How are you?
I'm good. Today, we are proud to welcome Kasim Sultan, who's carved out quite a career over the years for himself and his 46-plus years as a professional musician. Chances are that Kasim's accomplishments are an indelible part of your daily playlist, whether you realize it or not. To date, he has played and sung on albums that have sold more than 85 million copies, regularly performing and touring with world-renowned bands and artists. To name a few, Todd Rundgren, who we'll delve in deep with because he's done a lot with Todd over the years, as well as was a member of Joan Jett and the Blackhearts for a time, and Blue Oyster Cult. He's worked with Meat Loaf, Hall & Oates, Cheap Trick, Patti Smyth, Indigo Girls, Steve Stevens, Richie Sambora, Patti Smith, and many more. So we're proud to welcome to the Music Buzz Podcast, Kasim Sultan. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's a real honor and pleasure to be here.
And we tried to do this, we were talking earlier, like six times. So the fact that we're even talking is really, that's an accomplishment in and of itself.
I was completely ready for today not to happen.
Me too.
We were planning this before the pandemic. Yeah. You know, it's like, wow, I don't know how this happened.
We're probably the next pandemic is when people get to it.
That's not funny.
No, let's not go there. Kasim, it's great to have you here, man. I want to start out, of course, everybody's familiar with your work with Todd, especially. And I knew you were a great player and a great singer, but man, I had no idea how accomplished you are. I listened to Kasim 2021, delved into it widely. Well, now it was a couple of weeks ago, and I listened to it again today. And if you don't mind, I'm just going to go through and talk about this record because I think our listeners, one and all, would do themselves a great honor to check this record out.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate that. Sure.
I was knocked out. More Love, tune number one. What a great way to start an album. That's a great tune, great vocals from you, and most of all, a great message. The band's cooking. I don't know how you could start a record out any better than that.
That was the last song we recorded for the record. We had finished, Phil and I did the whole record with Phil Thornalley, and Phil produced. We've been writing buddies and kind of cohorts since mid-90s when we met and kind of, you know, shared some musical interests and thought it would be a good idea to do some work together. We've been working together ever since. And this was the first record that Phil produced top to bottom. I've worked with him on a number of other records over the years. Yeah, we finished the record. We finished recording everything. And Phil said, you know, we need one more song. And I have this idea kind of floating around, and played me the demo for it. And I said, yeah, sure, that might work. We finished it up, and then it's just one of those happy accidents where you have a finished piece of music and you say, you know what, this is how the record should start. So the record starts with the last song recorded. Yeah, I'm real proud of that record. It's a really, really good record.
It really is, man. The second tune, Unsung, it's got a great magical mystery tour kind of a thing about it. Man, I just love it. If you dig the Beatles, you're going to dig this. We'll compare people with something, but that's only in a light of saying, man, if you dig this, you need to check this out. But it's beautiful.
Cool. We completely ripped off the Beatles on that one. There's a direct rip from I Want to Tell You. This is a little quirky piano thing. And the song Came Together was one of the first songs that Phil lives in London. I did most of the record in London. And I had some ideas and I brought them over to Phil. And we kind of, you know, piecemeal finished song by song by song. Unsung. That's the kind of material that I gravitate towards, that kind of, you know, quirky pop music, little on the Beatles side. I mean, I could name a half a dozen other bands that are similar to that genre, but that's my comfort zone, that type of 3.5 minute pop song that, you know, kind of has a couple of hooks here and there, and it's nice and you can hum along and you remember it for 5 minutes.
Well, it's a nice pop shuffle. And it makes you bob your head right off the bat, you know, even if you're not listening intently. But if you listen intently, then you start catching all the little nice little bits in it. Yeah, I think it's great, man. I was knocked out by this record. Blame Somebody Else. Real cool Mellotron opening. A great key change in the chorus. Great arrangement.
That song is like a more or less a nod to Weezer. It's kind of it's got a real Weezer chorus in it. Again, you know, I grew up, I am a child of the 60s, both aesthetically and musically. After the Beatles opened that floodgate, not just British rock, but rock from this country as well. There was this influx of heavy, heavy music like Led Zeppelin and Jeff Beck from the Beck A La album and Blind Faith and Cream and then Black Sabbath and stuff like that. And that was all stuff that I listened to. It kind of, whether you want to agree or not, it plays a role in how you interpret your own music.
Oh, sure. It has to.
While I claim to be a pop songwriter, it's like there's a heavy element, the stuff that I gravitate towards as well.
It's called osmosis.
And that makes it more palatable for nowadays anyway, if you heavy it up. Like Queen heavied up the Beatles too, you know, it just kind of keeps getting passed down. And the next song has my favorite lyric in it, which was God Kicked a Stone, but the lyric is, just one more stone that God kicked around. That's really good.
Well, you know, the funny thing about that is that when we wrote the song, Phil came up with the title because of his accent. It was originally written as just one more stone that got. And I said to Phil, I said, you know, really cool is if we kind of made it about God, you know, and it's like, you know, God just kind of playing the game. Yeah, well, you want to make God laugh, have a plan. And then we just kind of skewed the lyrics to make it God-centric, as opposed to just a generic one more stone that got kicked around. It's like, I could have sworn. I said, did you say God kicked around? He says, no, but I love that. And I said, well,
that's great. Yeah,
that was a happy accident for sure.
It's almost so obvious that it's one of those when you hear that, like, oh, that makes perfect sense. Why have I never heard that before?
And God would have been fine, too, but God is like, yes. And you know what? It reminds me, that song, you know, we talk about bands from the 60s. It's got kind of a Kinks, about 1967, something else kind of a feel, with the tuba bass and Dead End Street or Big Black Smoke or one of those tunes.
Yeah, just real quirky stuff, you know, just stuff that is a little off the grid.
Who else do you listen to that's, apart from the fact that you worked with Todd, who's pretty off the grid. Who else do you listen to, apart from Beatles and so on, that you consider off the grid? I mean, I thought when Brian and Van Dyke Parks got together, that took things nicely off the grid as well. Who else do you enjoy?
I'm a big Rufus Wainwright fan. I think that his interesting singer, very, very interesting singer. His chord changes and his arrangements, they follow no pattern whatsoever. He is his own genre. And lyrically, Rufus writes stuff that is just, it's kind of hard to put your finger on, you know. It kind of doesn't make any sense. It's like a little bit of word salad. Really difficult to write those kind of songs and make them sound good. Another one is Jonathan Brook. I first discovered Jonathan when she was in a band called The Story with Jennifer Kimball. They did one record together and there is not a bad song on that. They were called The Story. And that's a great record. I have a radio show that I do every week, a terrestrial radio show called It's My World and Welcome to It. And I discover a lot of new artists by putting together playlists for the radio show. There's a young girl by the name of Madison Cunningham who does similar stuff to Rufus, but a whole new take on it. She's got a couple of really, really cool songs, you know, that kind of like weird stuff. And I mean, there's a lot of great stuff out there.
Rufus gets all that with his parents. You know, that's in his blood because they're both good songwriters too, right?
Loudon released a record about a year and a half, 2 years ago, maybe even a little bit longer. It was him with a big band.
Really?
He did covers of all kind of obscure Broadway musical tunes with a big band. And yeah, it's just fantastic. It's absolutely fantastic. Yeah.
The tune that I think that should be in a proper world, in Dane's world right now, the song that everybody would be driving around listening to on their way to work, duh, is Fast Car. It's a great rock and roll tune in the Badfinger, Raspberries, Big Star kind of a way. And the lead stuff, the double track lead, is like smoking hot. In Dane's world, that's on the radio right now. It's number one.
Yeah, thanks. That was like, I think, the second single, whatever a single is these days, from the record. And actually, Phil wrote that song. Phil is releasing a record, I think, within the next couple of days that has an alternate version of Fast Car on it. But our version, the version that's on my record, is it's just another one that's, you know, it's just a high energy, in your face, rock and roll song. Yeah, exactly.
It's a driving song, man. I mean, you know, in every way that you could use the term. And I'll just mention one more song that really flipped me out. And Hugh needs to go straight to this if he hasn't heard it. To Her, like a classic McCartney tune. Great string arrangement, incredible vocal performance. Tell me about that song.
That was another song that Phil brought in. And I just immediately fell in love with it.
I can see why.
I kind of fancy myself a balladeer. I've enjoyed that type of material a lot over the course of my career when I do my solo material.
Melancholy has a great place in ballads. And
I just really like that, you know, that kind of like, that kind of romantic, very little instrumentation, let the words and the melody speak for the song. And that's one of my favorite songs on the record, actually.
Are you a minor key kind of guy or major? And when it comes to that genre,
I would have to say that, you know, the saddest key of all. Some people say it's D minor, but I think it's A minor.
It depends on what movie you're watching.
You mentioned word salad a little while ago, and I'm always keen to know with musicians. I love writing and arranging. I dread lyrics, and I really respect them so much that I choke almost when it comes to really trusting myself. And I understand, I've said it before, why Elton has Bernie. How do you feel about lyrics? Do they ever come first, or is it always the music and arrangement that you bring the words to?
For the most part, it's music and melody come first. And then it is a complete Rubik's Cube to try to fit a lyric into a melody and chord change. It's a little backwards. I wish I was one of those people that could. I witnessed for the longest time, Todd would record a track and we wouldn't really have any kind of idea of what the lyric for the track would be, or maybe Todd had a title or something like that. No joke. I mean, he would sit down with a composition notebook and 30 minutes have 90% of the song finished with a brilliant lyric too. That's a gift. I was not bestowed that gift.
When you say composition notebook, you're talking about the fact that he notates on staff as he's listening?
In a notebook, just a regular, like a notebook that you got in school. He would just sit down on the couch and just start scribbling out a lyric. And next thing you know, you have Love is the Answer, which is a beautiful, beautiful song. So to answer your question, I paint over lyric. It takes me forever to write what I consider a decent lyric. And then I'm always like, I should have made that a little bit better. I should have changed that. I should have used a different word there. I should have been more descriptive. Or I heard an interview with a songwriter not too long ago that they were spot on when they said, it's more important to finish a bad song than to not finish a song at all. So just finish it. Just get it done and move on.
And you're still working on your craft, whether it's a, you know, a wonderful tune or not, at least you're writing.
Do you subscribe to that diligently, or do you have a lot of sketches that you need to go back to?
I have stuff that's 30 years old that I listened to, like a cassette that I made when I was still living at my parents' house or something like that. And I'm like, you know, I should finish that idea. That's a really good idea. I must have, you know, 130-second ideas on my phone that if I'm driving or something like that, maybe I'll listen to my voice memos. And I kick myself for not finishing, you know, half of the ideas that I have started.
The great painters sketch first, too, so there's no shame in doing the noodle first and then coming back.
The problem is that, you know, life creeps in. John Lennon said, life is what happens when you're busy doing other things.
Speaking of going back, obviously the big names stick out and who you've worked with, and we'll get into some of that in a little bit. But prior to joining Utopia in 1976, your music career began playing piano and vocals with Cherry Vanilla and also the Brooklyn-based band Sleepy Hollow. And I started thinking, gosh, that must have been an amazing time to be starting out in music in the New York area. Can you take us back to that time a little bit and what it was like for you and kind of, you know, getting your feet under you before you joined Utopia in 76?
I kind of knew I had one of those epiphanies when I was about 9 years old. And like so many of my peers, I saw the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. I watched it. And that February of 1964, and I said that's what I'm going to do. I'm done. Don't have to worry about school. Don't have to worry about getting a job or anything like that. That's what I'm going to do. I think I got an electric guitar a couple of years, maybe a year and a half later for Christmas. And I taught myself how to play. That was just something that I knew exactly what my purpose in life was. When I got old enough to kind of venture out on my own, I guess I was about 14 years old, and a friend of a friend was a recording engineer in Manhattan. And he worked, a guy by the name of Vinnie Leary. He used to be in a band called The Fugs, which was a 60s alt band.
The first curse word band ever, right? Yeah. I remember those guys. Yeah.
Yeah. And he worked at a studio called Variety on 42nd Street between 6th and 7th Avenue in Manhattan. I buddied up with him and I said, he must have been about, I guess, maybe six, seven, 8 years older than me. And I just said, you know, I'd love to come into the studio and watch you work. And before I knew it, I was a tape op. I was an assistant engineer, and I learned how to wrap cables. And I worked a variety of recording studios. I would go into Manhattan in, like, you know, maybe late afternoon, and wouldn't come home until 1 o'clock in the morning at 14, you know, taking the ferry from Staten Island where my folks live. And that was my first introduction to recording.
It's amazing. 14 years old. I mean, now you don't hardly let your kid go out on the street in front of your own house at 14. You know?
Yeah. What year would that have been?
That would have been 1972 or 71 even.
How old when you joined Utopia then? You were what?
I was 20. So then I was just completely determined to have a career in the music business or as a musician. I'm not entirely sure how I met Richie Belay from Sleepy Hollow. But at that point, I was a bass player as well. I met the band Sleepy Hollow. They needed a guitar player. I did start playing guitar, but I switched to bass to join a band that was around the block from where I lived. They fired me a year later because I didn't have an amplifier. I cried and went home crying to my mom. And I said, I'll show them. And then I started playing with Sleepy Hollow as the guitar player. My then girlfriend, who became my wife, my high school sweetheart, saved up her money from her job and bought me an upright piano. To my mom's basement. I taught myself how to play piano. And there was an audition that had come up. A buddy of mine said, I'm working with this woman by the name of Cherry Vanilla. She needs a piano player. Would you be interested in auditioning for it? It might be a good thing for you to do. And I said, yeah, sure, I'll try out. I tried out for Cherry's band. It was me and this virtuoso piano player by the name of Jan Mullaney, who's still in the music business right now, actually. He just played circles around me. But I sat down and I did the best I could. I was a terrible piano player, but she hired me because I could sing. And that's how I got into the music scene of Manhattan in 1973. Started hanging around with Michael Kamen, who was in a band called the New York Rock Ensemble at that time. He was playing with David Bowie as his musical director on the Diamond Dogs tour. Another buddy of mine, Earl Slick, who was also playing with David Bowie at the time, who was a fellow Staten Islander, went to his house one day, and this was in 1976. Now I'm 2 years into playing with Cherry. I became friends with Mick Ronson, Lee Childers, Tony Zanetta from Main Man Records, all these amazing people in the New York punk music scene at the time. So I had to take Slick to JFK for a flight over to England, and walked into his house, which was about 3 blocks from my mom's. And he said, "Do you feel like playing bass for Todd Rundgren?" I said, "Yeah, I guess. I don't know." He says, "Well," I said, "when we get to JFK, call Michael Kamen up and tell him that you're interested in the gig and he'll recommend you." I put a dime in the payphone at JFK at the TWA terminal. And told Michael that I was interested in auditioning for Todd Rundgren's band. He said, "I don't even know that you play bass." He said, "I thought you played piano." I said, "Well, bass is my main instrument." I said, "I do play piano, but I am also a bass player." And he recommended me. I got the call the next day, took an Adirondack Trailways bus from Port Authority up to Woodstock. That's how my professional career started.
What were your inspirations as a piano player? I'm a piano player, and I wanted to, at that time, who were you listening to? Was it Nicky Hopkins or Elton John or Leon?
Absolutely, Nicky Hopkins. I was just going to say Nicky Hopkins, Max Middleton. Richard T was one of my biggest influences, and we used to go see him with stuff at McKell's up on the Upper East Side in Manhattan. Just an amazing piano player. And, you know, I can't imagine being that good. You know, to this day, I'm not really a piano player. I play piano, but...
Well, so does Neil Young and so does Paul McCartney, you know.
But, you know, I mean, being around some of the most brilliant pianists like Roy Bittan, I've worked with Roy a bunch, and the guy who's currently works with Todd Gilliseas, who's an amazing piano player. I mean, I could rattle off a half a dozen names of people that I work with that I just wish I was, you know, one tenth as good as.
Did you ever see people like Bill Payne?
No.
Yeah, he's a pretty monstrous piano player.
I'm a big Little Feet fan.
Yeah, their piano player, Billy, was amazing. And so was watching Keith Jarrett live, which is a whole other genre. Have you ever seen him?
No, I've never seen Keith. No. Very sad, though, that he can't be anymore.
I know. I can't imagine.
So we always like to talk on this show, and obviously, you know, you played on some really big records over the years. Obviously, Bat Out of Hell is on there. You got the Rundgren stuff, Joan Jett stuff. But we always like to talk about artwork because of Hugh's history of, you know, doing all the Rush work for all these years amongst all the other bands that he's done album covers for. So I'm going to kick it over to Hugh to talk about artwork for album covers a little bit.
There's some fundamental questions I'm always curious to ask, and that is, how much did it matter to you? Some musicians are all about the music, you know, fuck art, let's dance. So when you were buying music, how much did shelf appeal and how much did the covers speak to you? When you were inside the band Utopia or even in your own career, how much did you have to do with navigating through the artwork, or do you just leave it to the label and move on?
Well, I think that's a really, really, really good thing to talk about because back then, this like, I hate that.
You mean before we started feeding off the carcass of what used to be the music business? That back then?
It just makes me feel really old when I say back then. I remember the Meet the Beatles cover, and it's just how dark it was and how kind of foreboding it was. And then you put the record on and it's like this happy, happy music, you know, and everybody's like, you know, talking about love and this and that. But the photo was just the antithesis of the music, really. Then after that, the way that album covers kind of progressed was, you know, Led Zeppelin had that first Led Zeppelin album. That was more about the music. It wasn't a Led Zeppelin 3 with the circle disc in it. That was really cool. And the first album that really kind of, like, when I saw the cover, that really just took me by surprise was King Crimson.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Oh, sure. The first King Crimson.
Yeah, The Court of the Crimson King. That record cover was just like, that was just like an acid trip.
As was the record.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah.
And then Zappa, like Hot Rats. Zappa always had great album covers. So that was a time where you would get the record, you'd go home, you'd put the record on, and you would just stare at the cover, at the liner notes, and you'd read them again and again and again. And the gatefold records that you used to clean your marijuana on, it was a whole experience, you know.
Did you ever buy music based on the strength of a cover?
No. Never bought a piece of music because I liked the cover. It was always on either a recommendation of, oh, you got to hear this, or hearing something on the radio and saying, I got to own that.
I looked at some of your covers, you know, the Interview magazine, the sort of Andy Warhol paint over photography kind of look. Was that something that you enjoyed? Was that something you requested? Is it a look that you liked, or was it just
quid pro quo? That's my second solo record. That came out in like 2004. That was a record that I had complete control over, and I worked with a graphic designer, a guy by the name of Dave Fletcher, really, really, really lovely guy. I was not so concerned with the album cover as I was with the music, because it was a good, oh God, I don't know, 20 years between albums. I was more concerned about what was inside than what was outside.
Yeah, they've got to obviously approve the cover, but some people kind of leave it to the others, you know, leave it to the art director and so on. And some people get very involved. That's why I was asking you.
Yeah, I didn't have a whole lot of money at that time, and I funded that record all by myself. So it was either spend $3,000 on mastering or spend $2,500 on a cover. I went for the mastering.
Understandable. What period of time were you with Joan Jett?
So I played with Joan from 1986 to 1989 or 90.
Ricky Bird was there.
Yes.
Yeah, he's a buddy of mine.
I love Ricky. We're very close. We're still very good friends, and we do work together every so often. Ricky's a brilliant guitar player. We had a lot of fun in Joan's band. We had a really, really good time playing that music. For me, Joan came at a time Utopia had just kind of dissolved, and that was the beginning of our long hiatus. We never actually broke up, but we did stop working. There was a lot more supply than there was demand, and so we kind of took a pause, and I was left with nothing to do. My friend Tommy Price, who had just finished about maybe 7 or 8 years with Billy Idol, I don't know how many years he's with Billy, but he was on all the big records, White Wedding and Charmed Life, and when there was Rebel Yell. So Tommy and I grew up together. As a matter of fact, we were on our first band together in the eighth grade. And Tommy was one of those guys at that time that he was getting all the calls in the New York music scene. He had just finished. He was playing with Mink DeVille and a Scandal. He was on the Scandal records. And if you wanted a great rock drummer, you called Tommy. So he started working with Joan. Joan's bass player left. Tommy called me. He knew that I had just finished working with Utopia and asked me if I wanted to come and do some tracks with Joan in the studio. I met Joan and we hit it off, and I wound up being in the band for another 3.5 to 4 years. I loved working with Joan. She is absolutely nobody better than Joan at what she does. I'm really honored to have been a Blackheart for 3.5 years.
Yeah, you were.
Can you share a little bit about your involvement with Meatloaf? Seems like you were really, really involved in that whole process, not just Bat Out of Hell, but also the second round, right?
So we did the first record, Bat Out of Hell, which has become Bat Out of Hell 1. We did that in 1976. 1976. We started recording that record in the winter of 1976. At the end of that record, the basic tracks on that record are just myself, Roy Bittan, Max Weinberg, and Todd Rundgren on guitar. We did that entire record, just the four of us. And of course, then there was a bunch of overdubs and whatever else. When we finished that record, I swore I would never hear it again. This is the last I'm ever going to hear this music. About a year and a half after that, I was driving in my car, going up to Woodstock to start a Utopia record. I was listening to WNEW-FM on my car stereo, and I heard something that was vaguely familiar on NEW. And I'm like, where have I heard that before? I've heard that. Oh, yeah, that's that record I did a year and a half ago. That's those two guys, Jim Steinman and that guy Meatloaf. Oh, great. They got their record on the radio. Isn't that cool? That's really nice for them.
And then it happened again and again and again.
Yeah, and then the record just exploded. And we started Bat Out of Hell 2 after that, but that never wound up never coming to pass. Back then, just to put a button on the story. So, you know, I mean, I remained friendly with Meat and Jim over the years. Myself and Jim did other work together on, because Jim wrote songs for everybody from Barry Manilow to Celine Dion, Barbra Streisand, Air Supply, just a ton of other artists. I guess it was I was playing with Hall and Oates at the time, and we were in Australia. We were doing a tour. We were staying in Sydney. We're at the Intercontinental Hotel, and I went downstairs for breakfast. And who do I run into but Meatloaf? It was over there for a softball tournament. We had just finished. I did the backgrounds on Bat Out of Hell 2 with Todd. Myself, Todd Rundgren, and Rory Dodd did all the backgrounds on that record, all the background vocals. You know, Meat said, Chasm, I'm putting a band together for my new record for the tour. You feel like coming in playing keyboards and guitar? We need a good background singer too. I was like, yeah, sure. Hall and Oates weren't working at that time. They had finished touring and I was off the road. And I wound up with Meatloaf for that tour. And for the next 17 years, I was in the band, 10 of which I was his musical director.
Wow, that's amazing.
I absolutely loved working with Meat and putting bands together for him and playing that music. And like I said, I started off as the utility guy in 98, I think. I went back to being a bass player in the band and the MD. I treasure that time like nobody else. I mean, it doesn't hurt that, you know, Bat 2 was number one in this country for 11 weeks. And I'd Do Anything for Love was, you know, just one of the biggest songs of the year in 1994, I think.
What years was that then?
I was with Meatloaf from 1993 in his live band, 1993 to 2010.
I remember that when I started in the business myself at Sunshine Promotions, the first shows that came across my desk the very first day were a bunch of Meatloaf shows. They must have been your shows.
You know, it's funny because I say it's funny, but it's actually very, very sad that the only two people that aren't around from those huge records are Jim and Meat. Jim passed away 2 years ago and Meat passed away earlier this year.
Oh, to your term, way back when. I mean, that's testament to the fact that we are only immortal for a limited time.
Yeah.
I want to know who your bass player influences were.
You know, those early Beatle records were, they were kind of, the bass was a little anonymous on them. It was a little bit hard to pick it out. Just because as records developed, as recording processes developed, the bass became more and more prevalent. And Paul McCartney has always been a huge influence on me. But along the way, that first couple of Led Zeppelin II was my introduction to John Paul Jones and just his take on that heavy kind of, he was never in the way, but he always played the right thing, you know? And then one of my biggest influences in my early bass playing was Ronnie Wood.
Oh, cool. Yeah. With the Jeff Beck group. Yeah.
Yes. And that Ron Wood, that Beckola album, and what he did on that record, and that just the sound, the rawness of that sound. And he had this attitude of like, I don't care. I don't care. I'm going to play whatever I feel like playing. Am I in the way of the vocal? Probably, but I don't care. and so that was a big, big influence on me.
Those guys was a really underrated band. The Truth and that record with the Apple on it were two classic records. Pre-Led Zeppelin. Actually, the first one was the Truth record. But yeah, Ron Wood, man, smoking bass player. How about vocally?
We grew up on Staten Island. When I say we, I mean the circle of musicians that I hung out around with. We were into kind of pretty much obscure bands that you not necessarily would have here in mainstream, like bands like Backdoor, which was that was a band from the early 60s or mid 60s that was just drums, bass, and saxophone.
Like Morphine was, right?
I don't know Morphine, but Backdoor was a really interesting band. We were all huge, huge Terry Reid fans.
The guy that chose not to be in Led Zeppelin, Terry Reid.
Oops. Yeah, oops. And to this day, I'm still a huge Terry Reid fan. Those first couple of albums, Super Lung, and then Terry Reid, those albums were a big influence on me vocally. And the only reason that I became a singer was because nobody else wanted to do it. You know, nobody else wanted to be a singer in the band. And I'm like, well, fine. If you don't want to do it, I'll freaking do it. And that's how I became a singer.
Yeah, because you had Utopia's biggest U.S. hit, right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, the band was responsible for the production and arrangement on that song. That was my song. I brought it in and I sang lead on it. And
so in 1982 in Canada, while Hugh was busy making the Signals cover for Rush, you were ripping up the charts in 82 in Canada with Don't Break My Heart.
It's funny you should just mention that. I just was at my mom's house earlier today and I found a single of that song. So I did chart and have a top, I guess it was top, I want to say top 20 hit in Canada with my first solo record.
You need merch that say I'm big in Canada.
I'm big in Canada. I was big in Canada. Yeah. Yeah.
So I got to ask a question. So, you know, when you look at your resume, it's a who's who of rock stars and big names over the last 40, 50 years or whatever. How do you choose? You know, is it one of those things where you just kind of, your career's just kind of, you know, ebbed and flowed and it's just kind of presented itself? Or is there, what do you look for when you choose to work with all these different people, I guess?
I like working with people that are nice. I don't necessarily like working with people that are nasty or mean or aloof. A lot of times, I like to feel that I'm bringing something to the table that is you wouldn't have if you didn't have me. God, I don't know. I mean, would I if Gene Simmons left Kiss and they said, "Listen, there's a spot open, but you got to wear a bunch of makeup and 9-inch shoes," would I do it? I don't know, maybe for a second.
A few days.
I don't know.
Depending on what that paycheck was.
But you know what? At a certain point, it's I don't know, man. I don't know. I just love playing music. I'll play any kind of music. I don't care what it is. I'll play it and I'll enjoy myself because I have truly, truly been blessed to be able to do this, make a living at it. And still be able to, like, you know, walk by myself without a cane. I didn't do too much damage over the years. I am forever grateful to have the career that I have had.
Well, it's been quite a career. Absolutely.
I've been very lucky.
So what's next for you?
I'm working on new music. And I have a couple of shows coming up next month. I'm doing this. I got involved with this band that's celebrating the 50th anniversary of Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon. So we're doing some shows behind that. It's called the Gilmore Project. continue to work with Phil on some other stuff. I have, I mentioned earlier in the interview, I have a weekly radio show that's on in 9 markets around the country. It's called It's My World and Welcome to It. It's an hour of great music. Our flagship station is WDST FM in out of Woodstock, New York. I'm on every Sunday night at 7 p.m. I just finished a podcast of a comedic podcast called Unsung that's loosely based on my career and my life with my 3 children. The juxtaposition of playing in front of 10,000 people and getting in your private plane and flying back and getting in the limo and getting a phone call from the missus saying, by the way, the pails have to go out and we need milk.
sure.
And
been there, done it.
Yeah. So that's that podcast is available on all platforms called Unsung. And just looking to continue to work as long as I possibly can.
Don't forget about resurrecting those 30-year-old songs.
Yeah, man, get back on that.
You guys lit a fire under my behind. I'm going to do that.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. We're so glad we were able to finally connect.
Yeah, this has been a fun hour. Thank you very, very much.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.